Those of you who are regulars here at Holy Trinity know that we do a lot of work on what is often called discipleship or spiritual formation or that kind of thing. And if you're not regulars, by the way, a very warm welcome to you, if we haven't said that already. But this is one of those mornings, I think, where we want to display and consider that Holy Trinity's sense of itself, and this isn't going to be a talk about this church, so don't worry, but our sense of ourselves as disciples of Jesus is that we're on a twin journey, and it's simultaneous. It's not sequential. One doesn't come after the other. We're not trying to be completely spiritually formed until we can then care about people outside of ourselves. It's more like riding a bike, and both these things are happening all the time. Because there's a sense in which we cannot be fully formed until we begin to take on the heart of Christ for others. And that a major aspect of anyone's formation is their heart is transformed to that of Christ, who, of course, was the icon of existing for the sake of others. So specifically, what I want to help us do this morning is we live in a fascinating time of really deep, and sometimes it's beautiful, but often divisive pluralism. And I want to try to say some things about Jesus this morning that I hope can model what it can mean like for Christians to do what I think we need to do in our culture today, and that is to fully differentiate. I mean, if the kind of liberal experiment from the 60s forward in the last 50 years has taught us anything, it has taught us that accommodation doesn't work. People who want to accommodate just actually flee churches. So we need to learn to fully differentiate while staying humbly, lovingly connected, I want to say, to this pluralistic culture. Because the kind of fighting we feel and the antagonism we feel towards religion or the religious people sometimes feel towards, you know, the state of Colorado or Washington for legalizing pot, you know, can you just feel that talk radio, you know, cable news tension? Can you just feel that here for a moment? That isn't just to do with religion, but it has also to do with global warming, for instance. So those who are big advocates of global warming are now saying to those who doubt it, well, you're immoral. And those who are big, you know, on the other side will say that, you know, people like Al Gore are just, you know, self-serving alarmists. And it just goes on and on like that with religion, with global warming, with human sexuality, on and on and on it goes. Right to today. There are millions and millions, probably a billion or more people on this earth who do not believe that Jesus rose from the dead. And there are billions of people who do. So what are we going to do about this? And when a Christian says something like the resurrection is true, well, how do they know? How can they be so sure? Is it just blind faith? I mean, what is the evidence for the resurrection? And as I was sitting with this week, it reminded me, as Easter often does, that I was not always a believer, that I was not always committed to these things. They seemed weird and even like stupid and irrelevant. Like, what does a virgin birth have to do with a high school kid or the resurrection or the Bible? None of this made any sense to me. And so I'm really talking on two levels this morning, because I know on Easter there's always some people who are wrestling with their faith. And then there's us who I want to try to help us wrestle with faith on a more kind of global, social, cultural scale. And as I think about this, I know that there are more modern questions. When I was a young seeker, you know, college, we really did want to know, can you prove to me the resurrection? Can you prove to me that that cross bore life? And the questions have shifted. They're not so much that anymore. Now there are more things like, at net, at bottom, when it's all said and done, is the church on the earth a force for good or a force for evil? That's a whole different level of questioning. Or questions like, is there really truth? And if there is, can I, as just a humble, normal, averagely intelligent human being, can I know it? How certain can I be that I know it? That the resurrection, for instance, really happened? So these questions about God and religion, they've been around since Jesus' day. You think of the story of Thomas, you know, the famous doubting Thomas. Well, when he comes to Jesus, Jesus doesn't say to him, "Begone, filthy doubter." No, Jesus, fully differentiating, I need you to feel this, Jesus remaining exactly who he was, doesn't in any way compromise by saying, "Touch me, Thomas. Feel the holes in my body. Check the evidence out for yourself. I'm not afraid." And church, can I just say, if we can take that on, that humble, gentle, peaceful confidence, I'm not afraid for you to challenge us. I'm not afraid for you to doubt us. Because in our case, you know, we're worth doubting. We're not perfect like Jesus. But can you just feel his presence there? Staying fully connected, letting Thomas ask his questions, and Jesus just kind of laid out the evidence before us. But what about for us? When Jesus says to us, stop doubting and believe, when we start asking the how or why questions, you know, on the basis of what evidence? And so I just want to review a few of these for you today. Some of you, you will kind of heard this before, but I want you to know I'm not saying it to you because I think I'm telling you something you don't know. I'm saying it as a way of like rehearsing the way you do a really fun family story. Rehearsing it so that you can realize there is a place for us to stand in gentle, confident peace. That we don't have to answer the angry cynicism of the culture in kind. There's another place for us to sit with this. So what is the evidence? Well, first of all, there's Jesus's absence from the tomb. And of course, there's been many theories to explain why Jesus' body was absent from the tomb. The first one being, well, maybe he didn't really die. Well, the problem with that is he'd undergone a Roman flogging, which kills many people itself. These Roman soldiers were the best of the best, meaning they knew how to handle a whip the way somebody in a modern rodeo might, where they could take a whip, you know, and just flick a flower off that cross. Well, these Romans were perfect at whipping their whip such that the stones and glass and bone, sharpened bone, tore across the flesh as perfectly and harmfully as possible. Many people died from that. But then he's hung on a cross. And then because the Jews want to make sure he's taken down before sundown, they have the Roman soldiers go and break the other, you remember the two thieves crucified next to him, they break their legs to make sure they would die before sundown. But they get to Jesus, and they notice Jesus is already dead. These expert executioners. They were expert at this. This is what they did literally for a living. They were an elite little group of 10 or 15 people who answered only to the raw power of Caesar. And they went to Jesus and they made sure their job was done. But just to be sure, remember, they stuck a sword in his side. And out flowed all the fluid that had built up in his chest. You know how you get a little swelling when you bump yourself? Just imagine the swelling, the mixture of what the Bible calls blood and water in Jesus' body cavity. And out it flowed. He was dead. So it doesn't work. Other people have said, well, maybe the disciples came along and stole the body. And then they started a rumor saying that Jesus was risen. Well, leaving aside the fact that the tomb, again, was guarded heavily by expert Roman guards, these disciples were brutally tortured for their faith. And if they knew that Jesus was buried in the backyard, do you think they would have died for something they knew was a lie? So again, it doesn't work. It's psychologically ridiculous. It doesn't work. Others have said, well, maybe the authorities stole the body. But again, that's irrational, because if the authorities had the body, when the Jesus movement started, they could have just brought out the body and went, ta-da, here he is. You know, these followers of Jesus are lying, but nothing like that ever happened. Others have said, well, maybe robbers stole the body. But the problem with that theory is the tomb only had one thing of value in it, and that is Jesus' tunic. And you may remember from our readings through Holy Week that his tunic was of one piece of garment. It wasn't sewn together out of scraps. So apparently somebody like Mary or Martha or Lazarus or maybe one of the fishermen who had money had given Jesus something, a one-piece tunic that actually did have value. I remember when John and Peter go to the tomb and Jesus' body's gone, the only thing left was the thing that had value, his tunic. So again, it doesn't work. Well, here's the second thing. It's not just that his body was gone from the tomb, but there was his presence with the disciples. Our text tells us that many times Jesus appeared to his disciples and others. And again, some have rebuffed that saying, well, it's probably just a hallucination. Lots of social psychologists, lots of psychologists, lots of people have speculated that probably we don't want to say these people were telling lies, so then they speculate they must have been hallucinating. Well, of course, people do hallucinate. I mean, everybody knows that. But normally the people who hallucinate are either very ill, one way or another, physically or psychologically, or they're on some sort of drug or, you know, some sort of chemical that makes them hallucinate. And that's not true of any of these guys. These were skeptics. These were burly fishermen and tight-thinking tax collectors. And, you know, tax collectors just don't hallucinate. Although I have spent several hours on the phone with the IRS in the last few weeks trying to deal with an old problem from 2010, and I'm not sure they don't hallucinate, but typically they don't hallucinate. Well, the text again says that Jesus appeared to over 500 people on 11 different occasions. And so it doesn't really work to say that 500 people on 11 different occasions were all hallucinating. And then thirdly, there's the nature of his appearances. Hallucinations are subjective. They're not objective. They're not real. But when, again, the disciples are wondering about this, Jesus says to them, why are you troubled? Why do you doubt? Look at my hands and feet. It's me. Touch me and see me. A ghost, a hallucination, doesn't have flesh and bones as you see I have. Jesus ate with them. Hallucinations don't eat or cook breakfast or walk through walls. And of course, you know the story. All of this, of course, has an immediate effect. It transforms the disciples. And beginning with this little band of people, you could take out your smartphone right now and just Google, how many Christians are there in the world? And you'll find the number 2.3 billion. And that doesn't include the hundreds of millions or billions who have lived before us. That's just those alive today. It's just not probable that this movement began with a lie or a hallucination. And then lastly, of course, there's the experience of Christians throughout the ages. And this is where our own sense of formation, our own wanting to connect deeply with Christ is, in a sense, a rationale or an explanation for the gospel itself, our own life in Christ. And of course, countless of millions of people down the ages have experienced Jesus. People of every color and race and tribe, people on every continent, every nationality, from every economic, social, or intellectual background. All of these people are united in this one common experience of Christ. And this common experience of Christ has its roots in the text from Acts that Vivian read to us this morning. Do you want to look at it with me real quick in your bulletin? We are witnesses. We saw everything Jesus did. He was seen by us who ate and drank with him after he rose from the dead. And he commanded us to preach to the people and to testify. And this is where we get stuck. Because doesn't it feel like no one wants to hear it anymore? Everybody's heard our song and dance. Most of them think we've just become cultural bullies, trying to make sure that the whole world acts the way we want them to act, trying to enforce our worldview with its behaviors and attitudes on them. And so we're stuck. But can I just say to you, we're not any more stuck than Peter and James and John were? That the culture today is only surfacely hostile to us? They're not yet renting the pond or Anaheim Stadium and filling it with lions and throwing us in there. Nobody's being used as a torch for one of Nero's garden parties. But yet we feel it. It is our present day 2014 form of what you might want to call persecution. And this is what I want to help us see this Easter morning. We can't deny this. I mean, I guess we could, but you're denying all the evidence. And trust me, the most brilliant men and women in the world have tried to prove this false. And go read their stories. There's so many attorneys and philosophers and stuff who have, you know, sought to prove this to be false, and they end up coming to the conclusion that it's not false. All the evidence is against thinking that it didn't really happen. So we can't deny that. But the cultural blowback is real. What do we do? And this is what I want to say to you, beloved church. We fully differentiate as Christians in a highly particularized way. But we simultaneously stay loving connected to a culture who doesn't really dig us. Humbly, lovingly, openly, relationally, vulnerably connected to our culture around us. Because it is possible, I want to say this morning, to tell the truth without being a hater. To share your point of view without being mean or rude or disrespectful of other points of view. Here's a sample. And I say it with all respect. No other religious leader rose from the dead. They don't even make a claim. Not Moses, not Abraham, not Muhammad, not Buddha, not Confucius, not Zoroaster. No other world religious leader claims to have or demonstratedly did raise from the dead. This makes Jesus utterly unique. So what can we do but fully differentiate around the utter particular uniqueness of Jesus? There's nowhere to run. There's no place to hide. I said last night, you know, just kind of feeling the angst of Jesus's first friends in those, whatever it is, 36, 40, 48 hours that he was in the tomb. And can you imagine all the stuff running through their head? Like, oh my gosh, what's going to happen? Are we next? You know, is something drastic going to happen to us? Are they going to come arrest us as accessories to Jesus's crimes? And I pictured in them the, you know, the totally understandable, you know, desire to flee. But where could they go? The horses of Herod and the horses of Caiaphas and the high priest were so much stronger, faster than any place they can go. And there's no place for us to hide today. You can't hide in cable news. You can't hide in angry talk radio. We can't be like the Qumran sect who just flees society. We have to find a way to put our face in the buzzsaw that we sometimes feel from society. And just stand there with humble, peaceful, gentle, but surety. Jesus actually did rise from the dead. And it does make him utterly unique and completely worthy of following. See, other religious founders, they just point. They point and they say, well, that's the way. Or that's the truth. Or here's the way to life. But no other religious leader says, I am the way. I am the truth. I am the life. But I know today there are many who aren't sure how they should be running their lives. They're looking for a model to follow. You know, what does it mean to be human today? What does it mean to be male or female? What's it mean to be an engendered person? What's it mean to be a worker or a business owner? Everything seems up for grabs today. And it seems like the traditional models are breaking down. And this is why it's so important that we hear Jesus say, brutally crucified, descending into the darkness of despair, rising again from the grave. Come, follow me. I am the way. I am the truth. I am the life. And you don't have to be a braggart or arrogant. You don't have to be hostile or mean to just simply say, I have chosen to follow Jesus. Like when I was really young and wanted to learn jazz piano, I would have been so proud to say, I'm a follower of Oscar Peterson. Anybody know Oscar? I would have said, man, I am a follower of Oscar Peterson. I wouldn't have had no problem saying that. Just much. I know there's other great jazz pianists out there. But for me, I'm a follower of Oscar. That boy can play. And something like that is all we're at here. And so while our present pluralism is, in my mind, understandable, and while it should be engaged with, in my view, with loving patience, it appears that concerning Jesus, even if we live in a relativistic, pluralistic time, there's not a lot of middle ground. As C.S. Lewis put it, a man who was merely a man and said the sort of things that Jesus said, he would not be a great moral teacher. He'd either be insane or else he'd be the devil of hell. You must make a choice. Either this man was and is the Son of God, or else insane or something worse. But let's not come up with any patronizing nonsense, Lewis wrote, about his being a great human teacher. He hasn't left that up to us. He didn't intend to. We're faced then, Lewis wrote, with this frightening alternative. For it seems to me obvious, he said, that Jesus was neither insane nor a fiend. And consequently, however strange or terrifying or unlikely it may seem, I have to accept the view that he was and is God, and his life uniquely creates life as God intended humankind to be, in its full beauty, in its full color, glorifying in maleness and femaleness and oldness and youngness and babies, the whole thing. Lewis said, I just have to come to the conclusion that this is what's real. He was not insane. He was not a fiend. So this, you might say, is kind of the challenging news of Easter. You just got to deal with this. I mean, that's part of what makes the gospel about Jesus uncomfortable, is every human being has to deal with it. Because again, it's different. No other religion makes the kind of ultimate claims that Christianity makes. And so when faced then with kind of a stark ultimate claim, then one has to simply deal with it. But beyond that, for the vast majority of us in this room who have dealt with it and are now trying to follow Jesus and be his disciple and just let the Holy Spirit loose in our life and the Bible loose in our life and the community of faith loose in our life so that we can grow as followers of Jesus, then see, we've gone beyond the point of having to deal with it, and now we come to the great comfort of, this is something I can rely on. Are you feeling me here? See, once you go past, this is something I have to deal with, it becomes something you can rely on. Do you see how I've stood here now for 23 minutes? Just peacefully on this platform. Why? I have come to easily rely on it. I didn't have to throw it in your face. I didn't have to prove to you the worthiness of the 2x6s upon which this plywood is sitting. I could simply stand here in peace and ease and confidence. That's the great beauty, is that we now can come to rely on this. And this encapsulates for us what we're all about here at Holy Trinity. And that is this journey inward, spiritual transformation into Christlikeness, for the sake of our journey outward, and that is to be the people of God in all the places we work and live. Amen.